Chris Hayes, I'm Washington editor of The Nation magazine, coming to you live from a coffee shop in beautiful Austin, Texas, where I am for South by Southwest. I'm outside, so you will hear bird sounds. And with me is Raihan Salam. Raihan, you want to introduce yourself?
My name is Raihan Salam, and I am from New York, but I'm in Austin, Texas as well, mainly so that I can genuflect in Chris Hayes' presence and also to see bands. And I'm with a wide variety of organizations, E21, New America, and a bunch of awesome publications that you should read more often than you do. And we're here to talk about the week's news, including the news that it looks like the health reform bill might actually pass, after all, after countless machinations, after a huge political Goddard-Damerung-style all-out, knockout, drag-out fight. It looks actually like we're days away from this thing actually happening. Is that a fair assessment, Chris?
I think so. I mean, I think that the vote in the House is definitely close, and I've been sort of corresponding with some people who are trying to track. I mean, the big question, just to talk pure politics for a second about the vote, right? The big question is how many people that voted no the first time can Pelosi get to vote yes this time? And that has to match exactly because it voted by – what did it pass? By two votes last time, so it has to – nearly match exactly however many defectors there are, and the biggest source of defections, people who voted yes last time and will vote no this time, are people, Bart Stupak and his, however many people he has in his posse, who are going to vote against it because of the abortion language in the bill. So that's the math right now. Dennis Kucinich obviously had his press conference yesterday announcing he's going to vote for it, and that's one – he voted against it the first time. He was the only one, I think, in the House to vote against it sort of from the left the first time, and he switched his vote. So that's one in the column, but where they're getting the other votes is still a little unclear.
I want to know what you think about Kucinich. I mean, you're someone who is, generally speaking, to the left of the congressional Democratic mainstream, and I know that you are a fan of some of the members of the Progressive Caucus. And Kucinich is a kind of quirky figure. I mean, having been a kind of pro-life, labor, left Democrat, he, you know, kind of abandoned that when he launched his presidential campaign, but has kind of tried to carve out this distinctive progressive identity, this distinctive, you know, kind of mavericky identity. Yet he also, I think, that has a reputation as a bit of a buffoon and as someone who's, for whatever reason, not to be taken seriously. And I've never quite, I mean, apart from, you know, kind of his maybe interpersonal qualities.
Right.
I wonder why that is.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I think that, he is very idiosyncratic and kind of quirky just in his affect. He doesn't come across, right? Like, he doesn't look like Evan Bayh or talk like Evan Bayh. But, you know, every time that I've ever interacted with him, I've always been super, I mean, obviously I share his politics largely, but I've also been super impressed by not just his his passion, commitment, but he's really thought things through. He's an extremely sharp guy and has also lived a totally fascinating life. There's a great profile of him, and I want to say in 08 that was either in GQ or Esquire. I can't remember which it was. It was a very kind of sympathetic profile, but in some ways it was the first profile I ever read of him that didn't kind of go down this somewhat like mocking, oh, this guy's a buffoon sort of route. In terms of his decision,
he was the mayor of Cleveland when he was incredibly young, is my understanding.
Yeah, exactly. He was the mayor of Cleveland, I think, when he was about 30. And in a fascinating turn, and I'm going to get some of the details on it, but he basically took on the local utility company. Now, there's some debate about whether, you know, how good a mayor he was and how well he managed, but he took on this massive fight with the utility company and sort of lost, I think, politically, and had this. He's one of these politicians who had a sort of early, you know, rising star career and then a kind of big setback and then has reconstituted his career after that. In terms of the substance of it, I think you're seeing the left largely coalesce around passing the bill. We're going to run an editorial in The Nation this week, you know, saying that, you know, Kucinich said yesterday, if I could vote for it, you know, then, you know, anyone should be able to vote for it from the left. You know, I think the bill is still, you know, problematic in a lot of ways, but I guess my ultimate feeling is it is difficult for me to construct a scenario whereby the cause of progressive governance and kind of the construction of a more robust framework for social insurance and social welfare, it's difficult for me to construct a situation in which the cause of that is advanced by this bill losing and crashing and burning. What do you think?
We've rehearsed this issue so much. I mean, not just the two of us, but also just in writing about this constantly. And To be totally frank, I think that your view is correct, and I think that your view, in fact, is incompatible with the view that this is also, in fact, a moderate, kind of conservative bill. It's a Republican bill. It's sort of et cetera. I mean, first of all, whether or not it's a Republican bill seems totally immaterial to me, and I'm sure that it does vaguely
right.
resemble proposals advanced by moderates in the early 90s,
right.
which I don't think gives
right.
us a lot of useful information. I think that, basically, as I understand it, I think that Roger Hickey and I think that Jacob Hacker, and I think that a lot of folks, kind of in their circle, a lot of folks who kind of have, drawn on some of their insights, whether they know it or not, are fundamentally shrewd. And the insight is, if this is a jury-rigged system that actually isn't going to be sustainable long-term, if you believe certain premises about, the idea of we need a universal risk pool, et cetera, this is not
right.
a stable equilibrium. This will indeed change, and the whole premise is to make the federal government responsible for this particular issue, the idea of covering sort of X number of uninsured.
Yep.
And I think that it creates a ratchet, and I think that the whole purpose is, and the president has said explicitly to Grijalva and to other members of the Progressive Caucus, I intend to fight for a public option after this, which, to me seems entirely natural. It seems like an entirely logical thing to do. And then there are others who have talked about Medicare buy-in and a variety of other proposals. I think that this is a way station that is designed to kind of win an argument on points. But the fundamental thing, the fundamental driving point behind this is that I think there are people who very legitimately believe that the federal government should be responsible for guaranteeing health
right.
insurance for all Americans.
Right.
And I think that everything
right.
else, all of the arguments about cost, all of this stuff is so incredibly specious. I mean, the CBO numbers that we saw released on Thursday, the thing is that, they actually explicitly say, hey, we actually haven't had time to do a full and thorough analysis of how the reconciliation bill lines up with the original bill, et cetera. And you kind of see these numbers where the CBO does not look at employment levels. They do not look at some basic questions that you'd want answered if you really wanted to know how legislation is going to work. What we have are people on the Republican side and on the Democratic side who understand how the very distinctive CBO process works, and they give you numbers
right.
that are designed to match the political cycle. And I don't mean that the CBO bureaucrats are dishonest or anything like that. I think they're absolutely honest, scrupulous, highly impressive, highly, credentialed people. But I think that we're just having this weird shadow boxing debate. And I think the debate we ought to have had all along is, well, should this be the responsibility of the federal government? And,
right.
What are the resources we're willing to commit? What is the smartest way of going about this? And
right.
so I found it really infuriating because lots of people that I think of as smart and thoughtful people have, I think, been playing this game of, well, this is it, and this is somehow a stable equilibrium, and this is a thing, and trying to say two things out of both sides of their mouth, and it just is very frustrating
right.
for me.
Well, I agree with you in the sense that, I agree in a few sort of key ways. One, I do think, for me as a progressive, the one thing this does is that it does commit to the principle that this is the, this is the responsibility of the federal government, right? Like, it converts something into a political issue, and it's hard to see how, like you said, a one-way ratchet, how that ever gets converted back. So it's now it's a political problem when premiums are going up, right?
Yeah.
But it's not the federal government's responsibility right now and to deal with that, right? That's the argument we're having. When this passes, that you're right. I think that argument's done, right?
Because I think that's absolutely right. And Jonathan Gruber, a lot of folks have said this explicitly. They've said that you do the cost control for we get what we can get in this bill first, and then you suddenly have the power, you have the political coalition
yes.
behind actually putting tough things in place that can actually control costs.
Yes.
And the most effective way to do it, frankly, is a strong public option. If you're only
right.
looking at the money the federal government is spending on it rather than global sort of et cetera. I mean,
well,
if that's kind of your key goal.
And then eventually what's going to happen, I mean, this is something that Ezra has raised a lot, and it's been raised on This American Life. If there's three kind of parties here, right? There's the sort of doctors and hospitals is one group. There's the drug companies, and then there's the insurance companies, and all of them, are part of what drives costs. The two of those have been largely left completely untouched, and arguably the two biggest drivers of cost. So the drug companies, as we have infamously been left largely untouched, except for these voluntary cuts. And on the delivery side, the hospitals and doctors have largely been left untouched. And so, this is health. It's the White House says it's health insurance reform. stuff, a lot more stuff is going to have to happen, I think, on the with those other prongs, and we'll, you know, we'll see. I mean, I think so. I think yes. I think I think that the fears the right has about this from a philosophical perspective, from a welfare state entrenchment perspective, are probably justified, and that's the thing that gives me probably the greatest enthusiasm.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. I mean, that's why I find this so frustrating, because the idea that, well, if you're a, you know, thoughtful, you know, kind of person who kind of intends to solve problems, you have to, I mean, it's kind of like, geez Louise. I mean, you know, I think that Ross and I have both, you know, really tried to make the case that, you know, yes, the Republicans are not offering a workable alternative, because in partly because that's not what opposition parties do in kind of our legislative right. system, which is a shame in my view. But you know, right. you could imagine a version of the R approach in which you actually put real money into state-based high-risk pools, et cetera, that is just kind of an alternative to the kind of forced pooling, the universal risk pooling concept that could actually right. solve a lot of the most, what are in my view, the most morally urgent problems. And also that could also move us, you know, kind of in the direction, it could be a different kind of ratchet in the direction of kind of what I would think of as a more sustainable health system. The thing is that we don't really know the answers to this. I kind of just, you know, we're all looking at the same evidence and we're kind of reaching different conclusions. But I think that, you know, I think that that's a legitimate debate to have, and that's very hard to have because the political incentives are such that, you know, kind of you're not going to have, well, here's my viable idea and here's your viable idea. Rather, you have, right. here's the thing that we can get past now, and here's how we're right. going to represent right. the thing that we can get past, despite the fact that there's actually a deep philosophical disagreement going on. And the other side saying, right. well, I need to stop it under any circumstances and throw sand in the gears, and that's pretty much it. Even if it means saying, oh, well, this is an unthinkable use of the reconciliation process, which I think is silly.
Right, but let me just say that the philosophical victory here, I would say, is the most minimal possible philosophical victory, right? So, like, it's the most razor-thin endorsement of the philosophical principle that I would espouse, right, which is that this is a sort of a necessary part of social solidarity. Sorry, the sun is now – I'm going to apologizing to the folks at home. We're going to move out of the sun here. Let's try that. That's much better. That this is the most sort of minimal endorsement of the view that sort of social solidarity requires essentially, you know, social insurance and risk pooling and the redistribution of benefits from the healthy to the sick. And I think that, you know, when you said, well, if it originated as a Republican plan, it's kind of neither here nor there. But I do think it's important to note that, you know, every time that healthcare reform has come up, it has moved in the direction of principles away from the kind of social solidaristic single-payer approach. And so even if it is a victory, it's in terms of a philosophical victory, it's a victory that's been eked out, I would say.
I think that it's a binary, basically. I think that, you know, I think the key thing is, I think that, you know, progressives should be, I think that they should be enthusiastic, as you're saying, because I think that it's a right. ratchet. And I think that whatever we're seeing now is a rickety architecture that is just not mm-hmm. going to stand, and it's going to create powerful pressures in that direction. But I mean, you know, regardless, it's an interesting question, and I think that it's been very interesting to see the evolving Republican rhetorical strategy in response to this, which has now come to this point of making a series of what I think of as kind of outlandish claims, historical claims, regarding how the reconciliation process has been used in the past, how a variety of other, like this whole deeming idea has been used, because my sense is that Republicans enthusiastically use this stuff. My sense is also that we have, it's a different kind of ratchet. It's a kind of rhetorical ratchet in the direction of kind of incredibly scorched earth stuff. As soon as, this is, you know, was Larry Lessig's point, as soon as control of Congress became contested, suddenly everything changed and our politics became much more vicious, and you didn't have a legislative minority that was kind of trying to, you know, kind of curry the favor of the majority behaving nicely. Instead, and that's just, I don't think that is surprising, and I don't think that, like, hectoring each other, you know what I mean, is actually going to do anything, you know what I mean?
Well, I'm interested in this process thing because I think it has been sort of so manifestly disingenuous and hypocritical, and that there's process hypocrisy on both sides, of course. That's in fact part of the nature, but I think it's been particularly, what's interesting to me is that so much of A, the rhetorical firepower has focused on process issues. B, I've had three experiences in the last 3 days with interfacing with conservatives about healthcare. One was watching the the Fox News interview in which Brett Baer had sort of solicited questions from the audience. They got 18,000 emails, and he was interviewing Obama. And two of them, the first two he asked were these sort of process things. Why all the arm twisting and all this stuff? And I got an email from a family member, not a close family, but you know, like a cousin who's incredibly bright, wonderful guy, you know, who's become very kind of conservatized, I think, like a lot of people, very politicized. And he wrote me this very thoughtful email about his frustrations and anger with the healthcare reform, and focused a lot on the process as well. And then I was on Mike Gallagher's radio show, and it was, again, this process issue. And it's just interesting to me because I can't I guess I wonder why that seems to be the thing that they're leading with. I mean, I guess there's a certain degree which it's effective, right? No one really likes the Cornhusker kickback. Of course, the old quote about sausage making, yada, yada. And also, I think probably because it's more graspable and visceral than the complexity of the bill and the substance. You know, people, it's hard to sort of get people to talk about risk pools or feel strongly about risk pools or, you know, Medicare commissions or whatever. Yeah. But it is remarkable to me the how much that these process issues have just really dominated, and the ability of, I think, you know, a concerted effort to sort of elevate them. You know, I never heard of Demon Pass until they decided to do it, and then of course you go back and it's been done a lot.
Here's the thing.
It never occurred to anyone to make an issue.
I think that it could be that we have different readings of, you know, kind of the last decade. My understanding is that a lot of concern about partisan gerrymandering, a lot of concern about Tom DeLay's tough guy tactics. There were many articles about, you know, I recall a TNR article just about the treatment of the legislative minority, under the Republicans.
No,
I mean, I think that actually, I actually think the process was an intense, intense fixation. And oftentimes it manifested itself in the form of constitutional arguments. Oftentimes it manifested itself with regard to judicial appointments and a wide variety of other issues. But I think that actually it was absolutely there. It was absolutely vividly present. And if you were someone who was on the right, you were incredibly, you know, kind of exercised by these arguments from the left that were, you know, I mean, very much in a tone of, you know, sorrow and like, oh, you know. And I think that, you know, and I actually think that a lot of it was substantive. You know, I think that there were a lot of legitimate points. But I think that, you know, of course the terrain changes because, I mean, the most salient issue now is not war powers. You know, the most salient issue is whether or not you're going to pass this. And I actually think that, you know, I'm with, you know, Tom Campbell now, you know, Republican Senate candidate in California. I think that, you know, I would prefer a much narrower reading of, you know, war powers or, you know, kind of more congressional involvement in that set of issues.
But
I mean, it's just that, like, you know, it's also just a matter of, like, where you sit and, like, what you consider to be the vital issues of the day. So if you're Tom DeLay and you believe that, like, waging war on terror is kind of vitally important, then, you know what, you know, breaking precedent and getting a couple more Republicans in the House, you know, actually seems like a sane and reasonable thing to do, particularly since it's not explicitly, you know, against the rules. And, you know, I remember at the time talking to folks, you know, a guy from Dingell's office saying that, well, really, instead of whining about it, we should have just done the same thing in Michigan and just zeroed out a bunch of Republicans there. And, you know, that sounds unpleasant and it sounds horrible, but I think that, you know, it's just, it's weird. And maybe this strategy works, trying to delegitimate these things.
I don't know if the strategy works. I mean, I guess my response would be like, I agree the process was something the left focused on a lot. I don't think it broke through in the same way. Like, you know, people on the left talked a lot about the infamous Medicare Part D vote and the fact that it was held open for 2 hours, which was totally unprecedented at the time. But that wasn't something that, you know, was on CNN. So I think there's just a sort of – there's a difference in the ability to sort of – those messages to break through. That's a difficult thing to sort of – measure, but I do think
You throw a bunch of things at the wall and you see what sticks, right? I mean, sort of. I think that a human interest kind of narratives advanced by the left, which are very compelling. You know, that sticks, and so other things don't.
Well, and the other thing, though, I mean, I think that one of the grand lessons of this era, sort of starting the Bush years, and it's something that Paul Pearson and Jacob Hacker write about in this book Off Center, and goes to the DeLay thing that you mentioned, and.
Have you read Scott Winship's take on Off Center, by the way? We should link to it, but anyway, yeah.
I think that one of the really fascinating lessons, and this is something a lot of us talk about here, is the difference between rules and norms, and the power of norms. norms are powerful until you just violate them, and then they're not.
Yeah.
And that's sort of one of the fascinating things to watch. So all these things, you know, like the norm of when you used a filibuster and what you filibustered, that norm, it was never in the rules. And Matt Iglesias has this very funny sort of, thought experiment of the extreme example of this, which is that, you know, there's nothing in the Constitution preventing Rahm Emanuel from going, you know, into the House and killing John Boehner and then being pardoned by the president.
Yeah.
that would totally actually be constitutional. But, you know, obviously the norms are such that you can't do that. But it's one of the things we're seeing, I think, a growing gap between the rules and norms, what the rules enforce and what the norms enforce. And as the norms degrade, I think what it means is you need reform of the rules. I think to me that's a question. And maybe that's a sort of puritanical, you know, goo-goo instinct on my part.
Try to reform the rules, Chris. I mean, and I understand why this is compelling. This is compelling this has come up historically. It always comes up when you have a kind of relatively large majority, partisan majority that can't get things done. And I think that then, you know, kind of there's a turn towards this kind of procedural reform. And then it tends to evaporate when certain legislative goals are accomplished. I'm not saying that this is your kind of view. I mean, obviously, you know, kind of, I'm kind of sympathetic to the kind of Marxian view that, you know, kind of we're all kind of floating in a superstructure. I think that it makes a lot of sense. But the thing is that I think that, you know, having kind of, like you, I'm a believer in having kind of trying to have consistent rules and procedures. And I think that when the desire to reform the rules comes out of, well, and this is not the case for you, this is not the case for anyone who's advocating this necessarily, but when, you know, kind of the initial spark is not being able to accomplish partisan goal X or Y or
sure.
Z, it's just not
sure.
clear to me that those are going to be sustainable reforms. And given the environment that we're in, my guess is that a round of procedural reforms that happen now will be reversed, because I think that actually the deeper dynamic is control of Congress is now contested, and I think that as long as that's the case, I think we're going to have ugly politics.
Well, let's move away from ugly politics and towards a totally awesomely bizarre utopian future that you paint.
I want to talk about your awesomely bizarre utopian future first. So this is going to be a standoff, because Chris, I don't know if the folks in the audience know this, but he's writing a book that I think is going to blow the doors off the barn that is American society. And it's a book about elites. It's a book about elite failure. And it's just something that I think really speaks to the tenor of our times. And I have a lot of tough questions for you about this. But first, I want you to kind of introduce your timepiece.
Yeah, so Ryan is right. I am writing a book. There's someone mowing a lawn outside. Sorry about that, blogging heads, folks. I am writing a book, and the book is about this is really awful. The book is about
elevator
the crisis
pitch.
Of authority in America. Yeah, the book is about the crisis of authority in American life, and you know how we've had a series of institutional failures, the biggest pillar institutions in the society. And it's those failures have resulted in historically low levels of public trust in institutions, and I think ultimately we have a kind of broken meritocracy. That's the elevator pitch version. That's the essay in Time magazine, and it's the book I'm writing. And I don't want to get too far into it because, you know, every time you know this, Raihan, from when you and Rosh wrote that book, that you're trying to kind of balance between, you know, articulating the ideas and being involved in exchanges about them, and also sort of not showing too much of what you're actually going to end up producing.
Of course. So here's my tough question for you, and it's a question that I imagine you're getting constantly. I imagine you're getting a lot from folks on the right, but I think that you, and again, you're going to discuss this at greater length in the book, but I think that you offer an incredibly compelling reading of some of the pathologies of our politics. You offer a very compelling reading of the limits of our administrative capacity, the way that, you know, kind of power is gamed, what it means to seek power, the systems through which people acquire and entrench themselves in power. And yet, I think that, you know, part of it is just a very deep belief you have in the power of self-organization, and that's something that I share. but it's in the power of self-organization to shape our collective life through political institutions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, for example, right. labor unions. You know, my mother right. is someone who's pretty left-wing. She's also someone who, over the course of, you know, being a union member for a long time, I mean, sort of kind of developed a pretty powerful distaste for it. And you know, kind of just being here in Austin and talking to folks on the street and just talking about their, you know, gut instincts about politics, they just seem to so not line up with the way that, you know, people like us line up in D.C., and it just sort of seems like this is why I kind of, you know, I'm sure that no one will believe this, but I kind of really do think of myself as a deeply not partisan person in that I just really think that, you know, you need to build parallel institutions and that the problem
right.
with the meritocracy and the failures that you're describing is that we basically have these monopoly institutions that control access right. to power. And I think that, you know, right. the real thing is not to kind of, well, let's seize the reins of power. Let's get our cadres together, seize the reins of power. And then, you know, the dictatorship right. of the kind of progressive smart guys, you know what I mean? Or right. the dictatorship right. of the right-wing right. wonks, you know, and then we'll kind of solve everything a la, you know, right. Chile, you know, in the Pinochet era. I just don't think that's not how it works. And I think that the key thing is self-organization, not through politics.
Yeah, so this is really interesting because I think this is a good segue into your essay because – I think we actually have similar diagnoses of what, I mean, I think we, partly because a lot of these ideas have been developed in dialogue between the two of us, but sort of similar diagnoses about, you know, what's wrong, what's broken, and this kind of institutional decrepitude and sclerosis. And yeah, I think I'm more inclined to figure out ways that we sort of, in a kind of democratic fashion, kind of reconstitute, reform institutions. But yes, my ideas tend to be in that kind of progressive tradition. Although I'm also really into institutional innovation, and that brings us to your essay, which kind of paints a picture of a kind of anarcho-libertarian kind of utopia. I mean, that actually is too reductive because it's even stranger than that, but it involves a tremendous amount of self-organization in your vision of what the future would what this kind of post-institutional future would look like, right?
Well,
and it's an incredibly exciting vision. It's an exciting vision, and it's also sort of fascinatingly, ideologically confounding because there's elements of it that are very kind of very left anarchist and very kind of techno-libertarian utopian.
Well, I think it's also terrifying. I mean, a lot of the reaction that I've gotten from people is basically what you've described sounds to me like Timothy McVeigh or something like that. And I actually take real offense to that, but I mean, I get it because, you know, when you're out here, for example, I'm just talking to a buddy of mine and just, you know, his politics are this weird mix of Ron Paul plus I want to nationalize all natural resources to pay for healthcare for everyone. You know, I mean, I think that this is, to me, this is the real world. And when I talk to my folks, and when I talk to, you know, I grew up in Flatbush, and when I talk to my neighbors, and when I talk, you know, I just, you know, you get a lot of people who think of themselves as, you know, basically loyal, regular, partisan Democrats who have very strange views that definitely don't map onto the views of the kind of wonkosphere types that you and I know and interact with all the time, and who shape our views in different ways, moderate them, and what have you. And I think that that's just something that really frustrates me. And I really, you know, to me, like the stuff that I was excited about and still am excited about, like, you know, if you look at someone like Marx, I mean, for him, the dictatorship of the proletariat was universal manhood suffrage. And it was, you know, kind of you create a regime that actually is kind of more humane. And very, I mean, there are a lot of ways these figures are misunderstood, or Fourier, or like, you know, you look at just kind of different figures who are like, well, can we find better ways of kind of can we find better ways of cultivating the kind of highest human tendencies and achievements? And I think the thing is that, you know, when you have a kind of society like ours that kind of regulates us all into a certain way of life, you know, it kind of makes – it limits the space for that kind of institutional innovation, what you see as institutional isomorphism. And I think that, you know, again, it's not like – I'm not saying, like, let's overturn it all. Let's throw over the chessboard. But what I am saying is, geez, you know, to people that I think of as would-be comrades, you know, on the left, I just kind of want to say, like, let's be a little bit more imaginative than, you know, kind of, you know, whatever it is that Barney Frank thinks we ought to do. Or, you know, if the health reform debate, I mean, okay, WellPoint is the bad guy, but Aetna is the good guy? I mean, it's just sort of like, you're telling me that this is our political debate, and this is kind of, or forget about political debate, this is our kind of debate about our humanity and the things that, you know, what our highest aspirations ought to be and what we're going to hate each other over. I mean, I just find that incredibly dispiriting, and so I find, you know, people that I know who are like, or when you're thinking about technology, and in a way this is kind of creepily, you know, you could say it's depoliticizing, and it's a kind of retreat into the personal sphere. But
yes,
you know, when
right.
you just think about, that's what I find most vivid and exciting, and also what I find most important, because it also involves going beyond the nation state. It involves going beyond these kind of conventional categories of who matters and whose narratives of suffering matter. You know what I mean? And, you know, when I look at, like, inequality statistics, to me, like, they mask the fact that, boy, how many folks have families, you know, a middle-class family where you have one kid who's bipolar or who's addicted to heroin or any number of things. Like,
right,
the real
right,
map
right.
of the world is actually a billion times more complicated than the Wonkosphere map of the world. And I think that the poverty of that map on the right and the left is, like, an actual moral, urgent problem. And that's why I just want to encourage people to think outside of it. But sorry for ranting. It's just...
No, well, I think what's interesting is that you end up, right, so the world is this, this is something you encounter as a journalist all the time, right? You go out into the world and there are an infinite amount of facts, right?
Yeah.
And when you write a feature piece, you say, I'm going to basically take this lasso and throw it out there and kind of pull together this set of facts. And that's going to be the story about whatever, you know, if I do a profile move on, that's the relevant set of facts, and that's how you kind of shape the world. And one of the things I think is true, I agree completely with two things. One is that you can never overstate the idiosyncrasies of people's personal politics and worldviews, which is something that if you ever work as a canvasser or an organizer, you encounter, because you knock on doors and people say all sorts of stuff that is just, you know, totally orthogonal to the political category.
But that contains
for
wisdom.
Instance,
yeah.
For instance, I would never vote for a lawyer for president. You know, I so vividly remember knocking on the door for John Kerry, and it was just sort of like, I don't know how to refute that argument. You are right that he is a lawyer and George W. Bush is not, and therefore, I guess QED. I'm not going to get your vote on this. You know, I mean, he's got – there's some internal logic there about – experiences with lawyers, what he thinks of the legal profession, etc. And so I agree that people's views, worldviews are hundreds of times more idiosyncratic and complicated than the kind of divisions of partisan politics. At the same time, I think what's really interesting, and I think there's political science data, is that the associational links between certain views that go together as kind of prescribed by partisan politics, and I think often some ideological coherence, I think grows stronger precisely because of the effects of partisan media and a highly kind of polarized electorate. And so I think you end up – I wonder how much actually the trend lines are actually moving towards exactly the kind of future that you don't want in terms of
– disciplined partisanship.
You know, in which we just do have this kind of – essentially tribal catechism, right?
Yeah.
That we learn because we, you know, we are cocooning in our media, and obviously, like, you know, I make my money off a publication that works on cocooning, and I think it, you know, partisan media is awesome and ideological media is awesome, and I'm a huge fan of it. But I do wonder, like, how much I wonder, I guess, if the trend is that, and I maybe there's data on this out there, if the trend is that the ideological connections, the maps are getting more similar in the world of people's minds to, like, the ones in Washington, or they're not,
I,
you know?
I don't think so. I mean, this is a legitimate argument, and we'll see how this unfolds. And I think that you definitely see that among the college-educated, and I think that one premise is that, well, as that slice of the population expands, you'll see people become more ideological. And my sense, you know, I mean, is that actually there's a growing number of people who are alienated from politics. I think that when you have people in D.C. or in these kind of very media-saturated environments, I think that the first year of Obama has, for folks who were kind of his intense partisans and who identified with him so strongly, I think that it's been a year of, you know, look at the recklessness of the Republicans, look at, you know, kind of how
right,
hideously
right.
partisan they've been. And I think that, you know, really that's a narrative that resonates, and also there's some aspects of it that are true. But I think that for many, many, many other people, I think that what resonates is this very simple core idea, which is that we believed that electing someone who is temperamentally the opposite of the last president, someone who is intellectually curious where the last one didn't project that.
Right.
Someone who is kind of thoughtful, asks incisive questions, really cares about reaching kind of thoughtful conclusions. This Brooks idea, which I think is right, that, you know, he's essentially a kind of moderate progressive who kind of wants to kind of, you know, kind of save the nation state and save the welfare state by kind of modernizing it at the edges. I think that, you know, there are a lot of people who have concluded that actually, no, you know, having someone at the kind of heart of this machine who just is kind of like a better dude in some ways is actually not so much immaterial as, you know, kind of not dealing with the things that are actually at the root of our discontent.
Yes.
And I think that that's and I think that actually that's a pretty smart thought. And I think that and it's about that kind of resonates with me. And so the question is, what do you do about the machine? Yeah, I mean, the thing is, but I think that the thing that's different about us is that I think that this is actually one thing that is very deep and important, is that I think that fundamentally there's a narrative about what the left is and about what the labor movement is. And I think that, you know, these things that kind of run together and kind of running from civil rights right through health reform and the idea, the project of, like, you know, solidarity that I think really resonates with you very deeply. And it kind of, you know, encouraged the sense that, like, yes, the left is flawed, this left is fractious, there are pieces of it that are deeply distasteful, it's compromised, et cetera, but fundamentally it speaks to you. And I think for me, I think that there are core conservative ideas that speak to me very strongly, but fundamentally what speaks to me is just kind of freako, weirdo American individualists and just this idea that America, I deeply want this to be a site of experimentation for the world. And I think that this is, like, I'm not a big American exceptionalism guy, but I do believe that there needs to be a space. And I think that our relative prosperity and our relative weirdness, this sounds silly and it sounds like I'm sort of goofing off, but it's actually, I really believe it's urgently important. And that's why any effort to kind of, you know, kind of like rigidify and, you know, kind of like sort of, you know, kind of through and centralize.
That's
what kind of really,
Yeah, I mean, your slogan then, I mean, in deference to our where we both are right now, should be keep America weird.
That's actually wow.
Isn't keep Austin weird? Isn't that the
It is. That actually is just so brilliant that I kind of feel like I need to give you a royalty.
I think keep America weird is actually, if I had to boil down the very complicated, unboil-a-downable core of Ryanism, I think it would be keep America weird.
Oh my god! Wow.
Wait. So I'm showing off my fancy South by Southwest wristband camera right now. Since we are in Austin, and I don't know if Blogging Heads really cares about what music we're going to go see, but I'm going to tell you the bands that I'm excited about, and you tell me the bands you're excited about, and maybe I'm going to see the Cave Singers today. Their second album is mind-blowingly good. I'm going to try to see the Temper Trap tonight. They're an Australian band. They were the kind of bell of the ball here, I want to say, last year. I wasn't here last year, but I think they really rocked it. They're kind of like this sort of U2, Coldplay, Radiohead, Arena Rocky band. I'm going to go see the XX, hopefully, with you in a little bit. XX, British, kind of trippy, avant-garde, very minimalist band that's gotten a lot of press, and their first album, I think, is just self-titled XX is just phenomenal and great music to write to. And then there's a band called Hey Marseille that's out of Seattle. That's this kind of lush orchestral pop that I really dig on. And their album To Travels and Trunks is fantastic. And I'm going to go try to see them. So that's those are sort of the big ones that I really want to make sure I see while I'm here.
Well, Chris and I went to rival high schools, and he went to Hunter and I went to a school called Stuyvesant. And there is a young man who is a Stuyvesant alumnus who is at the heart of a buzz band here called Das Racist. I had the great pleasure of seeing him last night. And I think of him as a friend. Himanshu Suri. Please.
Is that the Taco Bell, combo Taco
Bell?
Yes,
the combination Pizza Hut, Taco Bell sort of phenomenon. And he's also an incredible entrepreneur who is the manager of an incredibly good band called Keep Away that I recommend everyone listen to, and also the Tony Castles. Keep Away gave one of the most compelling shows I've ever seen. Das Racist is insanely charismatic. And the other thing that I love about it is, you know, I kind of, like Chris, I love the XX. I love music, but also part of it is also coming back home, having moved back to New York a little while ago. And just, to me, the swirl of kind of outer borough, ethnic melange, and like kind of like weird, just people like being kind of relaxed, but also kind of weird, and just the kind of like weird, like kind of tribalism and kind of pastiche and craziness. They capture it incredibly well and really intelligently in a kind of – it's just magical. You should listen to it. And Keep Away, they also have fantastic haircuts, so you should admire that as well. But Chris, what a pleasure to talk to you as always.
Well, it's great, and I'm I will I guess I'll see you in a few hours.
I'm going to see you very soon. All right, sir. Thanks a lot.
All right. Talk soon. Bye.